The Garden Cinema played host to one of this year's Awan screenings. Awan, which stands for Arab Women Artists Now, is an annual festival celebrating women artists from the Arab world and in the diaspora. Awan partnered up with the Arab Film Club to present a screening of short genre films made by Arab women filmmakers. They curated a small lineup of sci-fi and horror shorts, marking the growth of genre cinema in the Arab world, in a year that's seen the release of films such as supernatural drama Animalia by Moroccan filmmaker Safia Alawi, or the horror-infused A House in Jerusalem by Palestinian director Muayyad Alayan. The shorts screened were Lady's Coffee by Amal Alagroubi, which touches on the occult and elements of demonology, the magic realist The Call by Rifi Ahmed, and In Vitro by visual artist Larissa Sansour, whose shorts often depict dystopian scenarios that are uncomfortably close to unfolding real-life scenarios. The directors discussed their work and the place of genre cinema in the Arab world and diaspora with our audience.
So as Abla said, genre film sometimes is a lesser-known genre in the Arab world, which is why we thought we'd do something different today and have sci-fi shorts and horror shorts. I would like to start off with you, Amal, if that's okay. So this is Amal Alagroubi, who wrote and directed Lady's Coffee. And then we'll come on to Rifi Ahmed, who made The Call, and Larissa Sansour, who made In Vitro. So I just want to start off with each of you just talking a little bit about why you chose to tell this story. So your film was set in London, it was the horror film at the beginning, and then later we'll come on to how you made it and a bit more about genre. But yeah, why did you want to tell this story? Tell us a little bit about where you came up with the idea.
Wow. So we were discussing this a bit before we started the film. I'm half Emirati, half Syrian. And so Syria, you know, has been a big part of my life. I used to go back every summer. And this was basically me and my mother and my aunties in a house. This is just basically a window into our experience. I have been apparently going to get married since I was 13 because she always saw a ring in the cup. And I wanted to bring a little bit of that culture and that narrative to the UK, to Britain, and showcase, I mean, gosh, there's just so much to the film. There's so many layers, generational trauma. On the surface, it's just kind of horror film, but then it also goes into culture. And it, you know, for me, my mandate as a filmmaker is that I'm a social activist and a humanitarian at heart, and I want to bring my culture, my identity to cinema, to the big screens in a very interesting way, which is through genre. And horror is a medium that I found works for me. It's something I really enjoy as well. And I hope to continue making films in that genre because I want to be able to tell these stories.
Yeah. Nice. And I'd also just love to give a big shout out to Amira Alshanti, who's a member of the Arab Film Club who played the daughter in the film. So really lovely to see her on the screen. She's up in Scotland. Rifi, so
hi.
Hello. I believe Vanessa Rose wrote this film, but
she did.
Obviously you directed it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know what attracted you to the script and why you wanted to direct it.
Yeah.
Especially I know you're part Arab and this story was presumably from a Caribbean background.
Yeah.
So yeah, tell us a little bit about why you were attracted to the script.
So yeah, my background is I'm Bahraini Bangladeshi. And the stories I'm attracted to are often cross-blending in genre, but often characters that are a turning point in their life. So both myself and Vanessa, we went to NFTS and she'd done this play. It was originally a play, basically. And I'd seen the play and I was like, oh my God, I'm obsessed with this story. Because I'm also a part-time carer for my dad and I know the dynamics of what it is to be the child and parent dynamic and how that also... generationally has there's a tango there where when they're getting older you're suddenly becoming the parent. And I loved this magic realism aspect because it's something that I like to address in my work, which is this suspended belief between what's real. And I often find genre can actually be a really good space for revealing truths about ourselves and society in a more interesting way. So initially I'd see the play and then basically said, look, why don't we look at developing this into a film? Because in the play, the ending was a sound effect, which was, and I was like, I'm going to make that real. I'm going to make that real. So we went through a thing of development of it, and I wanted to look at it from a London story as well, because I've I've also directed films in Arabic and English, but I've always looked at trying to look at stories from a diaspora gaze, because that's, I'm also a product of it, and I wanted to look at how that experience could be shown. So we went through a process of then developing that, and then we applied for funding and then tried to make it happen. So yeah, that was the background to it. But the reason why I loved it was, it's at the heart of it, it's a mother-daughter story, and it's kind of touching so many themes like mental health. The idea that, you know, I think in families, even though you think you know someone, they're still quite mysterious to you. So her having this secret, which for me, sometimes I have these moments with my own father where I'm like, is he actually like spot on here? And I'm like, damn, he's really spot on. So I think society would have a certain way of looking at aging and disability in a certain way. So I just wanted to look at it in a fun space. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you. And if anyone else came to the Arab Film Club that was here before in August, another one of your films was screening, yeah, which was Medea. So I'd recommend that if you haven't seen it. And Larissa, the final film, In Vitro, set in Bethlehem. I mean, wow. Please tell us where you got this idea from to make a sci-fi in Bethlehem. I'd love to know where you came up with the story.
It hits me that all of our films are about diaspora, really. But also, coming from, I grew up in Bethlehem, and understanding the political situation there has always been just, you're just expecting a disaster to happen. So sci-fi seems to be an appropriate way of addressing it. And I wanted to set a futuristic film in which you see Bethlehem out, after an apocalypse, which in the current situation, it's kind of gives it a different meaning. This was made in 2019, and seeing what's happening in Gaza now, it just feels that, well, we are already experiencing that apocalypse. But with the, when you think about the Palestinian psyche, it's very hard to really almost talk about it in using kind of documentary, because I feel that fiction is more real. It describes what's happening on the ground in a better way than what is really happening. I mean, the more in the beginning, I used to make more kind of straightforward films where people kind of reveal what's happening on the ground. And I often felt that the audience didn't believe that really Israel was capable of such things. And so I wanted to kind of create my own universe where I didn't have to kind of deal with this kind of setup that forces me to almost defend my whatever the protagonists in the film are saying. And when you think about the Palestinian psyche, it's kind of weird to say, but it's, futurism is really appropriate for it, because whenever I try to change the look of the future in my films, it stops looking like the future. So the future is actually quite, has a retro feel. And I feel the Palestinian trauma is always something that we remember what happened in 1948, and we're always projecting a future and thinking about a future state. But really, reality is on the ground is we're slowly losing land. It's slowly disappearing. We live as though we're in a corridor that's between past and and future. And I felt that temporality is a very good a topic to address through futurism and through sci-fi. It's very kind of easy way and builds more dimensions in the storytelling.
Fantastic, thank you. It was very powerful, and amazing performances as well from Hayam Abbas. Thank you. I'd like to ask in a moment a little bit more about how you made that film in Bethlehem, but let's go back to Amal to hear how you made your film in presumably London.
So the amazing location you see, which everyone asks about, so I'll cover that since you're all probably going to ask, is in Henley-on-Thames. It's a private home, and the Belgian woman and her husband who own it They're actually like Egyptologists as well. So she speaks Arabic and she's very much interested in the Arab world. So we kind of had a ready-made set. And gosh, it took a while. So we crowdfunded this film and then everything got delayed because of COVID. And then we shot over a weekend. It was insane. As we say in the film business, everything that can go wrong does go wrong. And as we know, Fatin, our auntie in the film, shows up in the morning and said, I had a fall and I think I'm kind of concussed. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so, you know, they always say, tell the audience that. You guys don't know that. But yeah, it was a challenge shooting the film, but we very much enjoyed it. And besides the usual, getting the crew and cast together and finding the funds for it, which we all go through. Nothing so different. You can ask me later about some interesting stories, but
I think you should tell us now if you have one anecdote.
No, I mean, we had, you know, just so many fun. I mean, so there was no coffee in the coffee cups because I think they were all overly caffeinated. It was Coca-Cola. And then also I should mention that there are a bunch of Easter eggs in the film, so you'll have to watch it again because there are things in the background that you may or may not have seen, which kind of slid in there because it's always fun. It was an adventure. And you know, the producers are here, so Cat White and Bella Spate somewhere. I cannot see back there, but yeah. that was a process, really.
Yeah. Nice, thank you very much. And Riffy, could you tell us a little bit about the making of The Call?
Yeah, sure. It was a process. So Pep, who is here, he's our cinematographer, he's at the back. It was a real journey making this film because, look, we got our funding also during COVID period. And, look, we have a big scene in there where is the leap of faith. We need to have this for. And for me, that was very important in the story because it's about, it's the moment where it's about reality or do we believe her or do we not believe her? And so obviously that's a stunt. So we went through a process of trying to find flats around London. But also we knew that if we're going to do the stunt, we're going to have to do green screen. We're going to have to rebuild a balcony. And it was just finding also a space that gave you that high rise view of London, because that was really important to us. That because ultimately this story is about, it's a love letter to parents. And it's a love letter to immigrants and single parents like who've raise their kids and had to make sacrifices. So that high-rise space, so thank God for Pep's wonderful eyes, because he was just literally like, there's this place, it's the Trellick Tower, we need to make it happen. So we basically found a flat there, and because the whole story is technically taking place in a flat, which was a great thing but also extremely challenging, because even though it's a two-hander, we're having to think about also light, how light is changing. So we basically shot in that space 3 days, and then we had to do a half day for the stunt, which was in a studio basically. But it sounds really easy when I say it now, but it took steps to get all of those things, because it's part money, part, you know, availability. But thank God we had a team that really cared and pulled together and everything. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you. And Larissa, obviously there's a mixture of archives in there and shots from Bethlehem. Tell us a little bit about the making of your film, from the shooting and the editing and bringing it all together.
I got invited to represent Denmark in 2019, and I was invited in 2018. So I was told in July. And I had to produce the film and have it ready by April. So that was just really a very, very stressful time. I had half of the funding given to me by the Danish Film Foundation, but the rest we really had to start fundraising. So it was basically, I could have made maybe a cheaper film for that money, but it was just impossible with everything that was going on. We flew to Bethlehem twice, I think, and we also shot in Oxfordshire, where you see all these scenes where with the hospital scenes. It was in an abandoned school, boarding school that looks like the apocalypse, so it was ready, you know. But it was, and also we shot in London at an underground theater in Islington, in this round kind of space. It was quite challenging to shoot in Oxfordshire because it was completely cold when we shot it. We had to shoot it in, I think, December. We also were working on a limited budget, so we had generators that either we are warm or we have, you know, the camera running. So it was always very hard to do. But Bethlehem was quite intense in its own way because we had to have permits to go into the church and Nativity Church and block all the streets. So if people don't know about Bethlehem, it's just full of pilgrims. So this Nativity Square that you see is actually never this empty. It's, every 10 minutes there is about 200 people, so the police had to block them off. And we had only 10 minutes to shoot. And imagine like shooting also with a green screen and having all these weird scenes, and then the pilgrims started watching the film. So when we finished, we had the and everyone was clapping. So that was, but I remember it as a very kind of warm. It was very disorganized because the permits that we got all of a sudden, roads had to be blocked and they didn't get the memo, and it was just. It was the most disorganized shoot in Bethlehem, but it was kind of the most memorable and the warmest shoot I've ever been on. And everyone remembers it fondly. But the cinematography we worked with was the only one. She came to Bethlehem and also to Oxfordshire and London, so we had one cinematographer. And it was a challenge to shoot in different ratios because we shot in 4:3 and also... 8:3. So we kept on changing, and so we had everything had to be storyboarded in advance. Everything was calculated to the millimeter because, you know, when you work with sci-fi, everything becomes so expensive, so you cannot make any mistakes. I could go on for longer, but yeah, this is just an idea.
Fantastic, thank you. It's very beautiful. I think, I'm sure our audience members have lots of questions, so I'm sure you'll get a chance, all of you, to tell us a little bit more about various different things, but I would love to hear from some of you guys. So do we have any questions from the audience for any three directors? If so, please shoot your hand up. Rania?
In vitro, could you just explain a bit about what the symbolism was of that ball? The big globe.
Yeah, the black sphere.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have something that kind of talked of loss and nothingness, and this kind of represent a nothingness, a space that signifies nothing. And it also became a place for like a repository for Alia's, the young actress's memories and negotiation of her memories. So it was kind of like where she meets her traumas or remembers the past. And a lot of the archives are associated with it as well. In the pavilion itself in Venice, because it was actually shown as a two-screen film installation. So in one room you saw this film, and in another room there was an actual sphere, which was 6 meters high, and it had its own sound. So it was orchestrated to kind of have the two rooms were speaking to one another in a way with sound. When it kind of was taken out of its context in the film, it became a memorial for lost time. Whereas in the film, it's the only thing that actually wasn't present. We had to create it in CGI. So people interacted with nothing. I like how these objects change when you change the context for them.
Riffy, this is for you. I've seen your film twice now. I love it so much. But both times I've got something different from the ending. So okay. I wonder, I don't know if there is an answer. But I've always believed that she really does go up into space. That's never been a question for me. But I think the first time I saw that she was kind of going off and saving them from this asteroid and then coming back. But then this time I felt like she was dying and passing the mantle on to her daughter, who could then decide if she was going to take the call or not. And I wondered if there was a decision or if that's open to interpretation.
All valid. All valid. I'm great. I'm glad that you got all. I mean, I wanted to keep an ambiguity purely because yeah, you're right. There is also, there's a dual narrative happening here. You've got a daughter who worries for her mother. And when she realizes this secret, I don't think it's necessarily a sense of belief there. There's a question of like, oh no, I think things have got worse. And it's that case of care. When you care for someone so much, it's like, are they getting better? Or are they getting worse? So at this point, in a way, the mum's basically saying like, you have the same gift. And it's about whether you want to take the baton on. And I thought that was really beautiful how we carry that on, because it's still a choice of hers. She could take it or she doesn't. So we had a few versions of the ending that we did in the edit. And we came to this one because I quite liked that every time anyone watched, they felt a different emotion. So I have had people go, oh my God, she's gone. Is that what it is? And I'm like, I don't know, maybe. But it's a bittersweet, it's a bittersweet ending. And I wanted to, look at the fact that, I guess one of the reasons why I was so, like, a testament to you, Vanessa, right? But one of the reasons why is, first of all, I've never done a dramedy before. I'd always done quite, like, more darker work. And so it was a great challenge for me to do something that had a hint of humour, but also the bittersweetness. And I felt I could engage in that quite well because it's something I have to deal with my own parents a lot. They will call me the modern day clown because I'll make the most sinister thing try to be the funniest. So in a way, in this way, it's kind of the reverse when you've got a parent who's doing it. It's that dynamic of between the two of them. So in answer to your question, it could be, I appreciate that it could be any, I don't mind which one you sit with. It could be any of them. And I wanted that.
Larissa, this one's for you. How did you decide on working with Hyam Abbas in your film?
I always just admired Hyam, and it was really hard to get her to, not because she didn't want to, she was really, really wanted to be part of the film, but she was shooting Succession at the time, and that's why we had to fly to Bethlehem twice. But she's has such a range of acting skills that is just amazing to watch her. And an extremely generous person to work with, really wanted to be part of the team, insisted on being treated the same as everyone else, although she's just used to, you know, working in Hollywood. And but she's one of the icons of Palestinian cinema, so it was just amazing to, you know, work with her.
I actually have two questions, and forgive my ignorance, but I would love to know where the footage is coming from in your piece. And also, I'd like to know, in your film, is that like a proof of concept of something bigger? Because I was like, oh, what happens next? Or yeah, what the idea was.
What did you mean, the archives?
Yeah.
They're from different sources. There's the Library of Congress. There's Pathé. There's UNRWA as well. And then I also have my own archives from friends. But looking at these archives now with, you know, hungry people, I haven't watched this film for a long time, but seeing the archive with people, with kids receiving, you know, food and milk, and it just really is so scary when you look at the news now and realizing this is repeating itself.
Was it a proof of concept? Kind of, yeah. So I have the feature ready to go. It is of the same lore, but not the same concept. So it's not coffee cup reading, but it is basically, I pitch it as the Islamic version of The Exorcist. So it's about it's about demons and demonology in the world of Islam. Because for me, you know, growing up watching these horror films, I knew a lot about sort of Christianity and even Judaism, you know, the Dybbuk box. And we've watched loads of films about that. And then I pretty much know the Lord's Prayer now because I've seen The Exorcist so many times. And, you know, we all know what the priest does when he shows up. But I found that not many people knew about the Islamic perspective. So my feature film is about that. I'm hoping to use this short to raise funds for the feature. But also, I think it works in and of itself, like as a short, because people are always curious about what happens next. I mean, in my mind, I know what happens next, but and I'd love to write it. So, you know, let's get it out there. But yeah, I think as a concept, it will work. And just a little trivia, because you asked me a bit earlier. It's sort of kind of based on a true story, but kind of not. So my mom and I went to visit an auntie, and basically the thing that was haunted in her house was a painting. And so the idea actually maybe stemmed from there originally, even though, like I said, it's sort of part of our culture and what we do. But I think that idea could definitely be taken forward, because this whole concept of the world of the unseen and the seen, and I'm a sort of paranormal occult buff, like nut. I love this stuff. So yeah, just ready to make anything. Yeah.
We just have a few minutes left, so any more final questions?
Hello. Thank you for the amazing films. I love them so much. And my question is for Larissa, actually. At the beginning of the film, I felt that there's a bit of detachment emotionally, like that it doesn't get emotional right away. And then the more I spent time with it, I felt like this sort of backing off made me even more emotional and made me get invested in the psychology a bit more. So I'm interested to know, like, what was the conversation like with your actors and with your composer as well?
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I think, because I come from the visual art world, the concept is what I always think about, and think about what is it that I want to deliver. And I know, speaking with Hiyam and Maysa Abdelhadi, they always wanted to know what the emotion is, and I would always tell them, well, the concept is like this, basically, but what is it that, how am I supposed to feel? And it took forever for me to get what they're talking about, because I wasn't making a film about emotions. You know, the emotion was in the concept. But I think it was a good learning experience for me, because I actually did want, in the end, you can have a concept, but you also want to bridge that concept of what you know and what the audience needs to kind of experience as well. So. And, you know, I started appreciating what actors need to know more. Yeah. So, and I think, I think it's a mix of both. That's why maybe in the beginning you do feel that there is this kind of maybe more rational understanding of the film. But then the more you live with the actors, the more you get that emotion through.
And your composer? I just ask because I know Mila's a composer.
My composer was really unique in the sense that he wanted to work with very weird instruments. He went to Paris to try cristal bâché, which is like a huge instrument that runs on water. So a lot of what he composed was there, and he was also quite conceptual in his understanding of how the film will go. But also, I think the sound designer was very important, key to this, to the film. So it's a combination of everyone. But it's a lot of back and forth with me talking to them and deciding what's the best way to go about it.
Any more final questions? Great. So just double check. Is it just one more we have, just so I can manage? Okay, so we got, oh, wow. I always say this, they all pop up in the last few minutes. Okay, I think we're fine. We'll take 1, 2, 3, and then we'll wrap it up. All right.
Hi, this is really short. It's not actually a question. I just wanted to say that I'm so impressed with three very distinct female directors who've done just what I think is an incredible job of directing both the story and the actors. And to me, you know, I really care about women filmmakers, and I'm just really happy to see it. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. My question's to all three of you, actually, and it's about colours. The colours in your films were just exceptional, both. Your film was quite rigid colours. Yours, Riffy, was so warm and drawing, and you chose black and white. And I just wanted to just have some comments and to understand your process about those colours.
Do you want to start that? So the colour for me was really like part of the like storytelling process. So I wanted them, it's almost set like a stage play. They come in, they leave, but what happens in between sort of shifts. So it starts off kind of very woody and golden and red and warm, which is what I tend to love in cinema. And I think lends itself. I want to kind of trick you in that, and which is great because you were all laughing, to think that this is just a, you know, happy-go-lucky, very comedic kind of haha funny story, and then really catch you out and start feeling that eeriness. And I don't know if you noticed, but actually the moment where she flips the cup, we changed the grade. So it becomes a lot more dark, a lot more gray, a lot more kind of, like detached and cold. And obviously that's because she's almost opened a rift between the world of the seen and the unseen. And now is, you know, it's a Lovecraftian story. So it's this concept of things are kind of spiraling out of control. And am I crazy? Am I not? And I keep hearing these things and it's moving towards doom and destruction. I wanted you to feel that in the color. So that's my take.
I would say we wanted very much to feel the warmth and time of day as well. So like for me, it was about the juxtaposition of warmth and danger, because this homely space is suddenly going to be potentially a dangerous space. I wanted this kind of moment where when you first come into the space, the colours are attractive in a way that it's also representing our main character, Cora. But there's like a fine line between it. So we did a lot of work also in terms of Pep, you actually shot it beautifully, but we also did some work in the colour grade where we also looked at the notion of the sky. And I wanted the sense of that, the time period in which it's happening is like quite a short space of time, so to really feel that sun going set and that, okay, you know, there's this thing unfolding and how it's gonna finish. So we did a bit of work where our production designer Millie White, who is amazing, and we'd also chosen a space where this woman who owns the space, she colors her ceilings as well as her floors and walls, so it felt like being in fish tanks every room, because like her bathroom was pink, her kitchen was yellow, and her living room was turquoise. So already we were like, this is great, because we kind of want to be able to represent their emotion and the character situation. So that was kind of the thinking behind it.
I chose to work with black and white because the film has a lot of dichotomies. I mean, first you have a split screen, and then the actual space that we first designed it for was for two different screens. But it's a film about two different generations, past and the future, overground, underground. So it kind of like formally it made sense to work with black and white. And also I wanted the actual footage to merge seamlessly with the archives. So the temporality will to kind of, you know, obfuscate the what is now and what is...
And then I think we had one last question up at the back.
Thank you for indulging me. Last question. Thank you so much to the three of you. Riffy, that's for you, actually, this question. You know, I came here today. I was like, okay, Arab women filmmakers. I myself am Arab. And then I see a relationship of a mother and a daughter that are British Jamaican. And you're Bahraini Bangladeshi. And I just thought, this is amazing. That's what London's all about. And I was just wondering, could you talk a little bit about the relationship between the actresses? You know, because there was such a strong bond that was really lovely. And I think the themes were so universal that I was with them from the first second, basically.
Thank you. Appreciate that. We reached out to Jo. We really liked her. So we messaged her. We had a casting director, Xanthia, who was amazing. And for me, being frank with you, I started in film more experimentally and then went more into fiction. So performance, I up to date had worked with more non-actors than like actors. So visually, I feel I'm quite strong, but I wanted, for me, the challenge here was about performance and it was about making sure it was believable. So from the offset, we reached out to Joe and Mara, and they just, you know, testament to this because they loved the script. They were like, oh my God, this script is brilliant. So when I got them in a room together, honestly, half my work was done because they just bonded. And I was like, amazing, great. Now it's just about really tweaking. And the way I work often with actors is like, I observe how they take information. So I notice Joe is much more objective driven. You have to kind of needs to know what's the aim of her scene, whereas Amara really soaks herself into her character. So what I would do is sometimes give separate notes, or always give them the permission to be unpredictable, because they'd sometimes bring up stuff that I was like, great, we're going to use that. So yeah, in a way, casting is so important in that sense, because if you didn't believe them as mother and daughter, then this film wouldn't work. Like, it just wouldn't. And so real testament to them. And yeah, as a director as well, it made me feel like I took a step as well, because I'd never done that kind of genre space. I've done a sci-fi, I've done like much more thriller based stuff. So yeah, I also learned a lot of things from them as well. Yeah.
Great. Well, just before we have a huge round of applause, I'd just like to flag, as was already mentioned at the beginning, that the Awen Festival is on for another week. So please do check out the website for the next upcoming events. And if you enjoyed this and you'd like to see more Arab cinema, we are the Arab Film Club on Instagram and thearabfilmclub.com. So a huge applause, please, for Amal, Griffey and Larissa.